Family group welcome to Jeremy F. from the Pacoima group. That would be great.
All right, I'm Jeremy. I'm an alcoholic. I wonder, it's like, how many speakers do you guys have that say they don't have a sponsor and that they don't? It's just kind of one of those things that I wonder. And I want to thank you, Uncle Jim, for the call. It was definitely a first for me, but it was enjoyable. It was nice. It just shows me what kind of AA is going on. And I love that, you know, because if you're anything like me, like, I love Alcoholics Anonymous. It's the best thing that's ever happened to me in my life. I have what I have today because of Alcoholics Anonymous and the men and women in these rooms, especially the men. And because I was a little willing, you know, and I want to say thank you, Tammy, for asking me to come out and speak. It's an honor and a privilege to speak at a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I truly, truly believe that today. There was a time in my sobriety where I didn't think it was a privilege. I thought it was more of a right and also an inconvenience. You know, that mentality when I walked in here that I knew what was best for you, and now you guys will all be so much better now that I'm here. You know, and it was that chip on my shoulder, that young punk kid, and that typical newcomer mentality that I know what's best for you, even though you've been here for 20 plus years. You know, you're going to do it better now. You know, and boy, did I have a rude awakening. You know, I knew nothing. I still know nothing. I want to remember to not know anything. You know, when I start thinking I know some stuff, that's when I'm in trouble. You know, because I've watched it time and time again, guys coming in the rooms thinking that they know what's going on, thinking that they have this all figured out, and then they're out there loaded. You know, and some of them have made it back and some of them haven't. You know, I've buried some people, I've prayed for some people to come back. Some have, some haven't. You know, that's just a sad fact for us if you're an alcoholic like me. You know, and I love these Zoom meetings. Like, why? How else would I be in Visalia on a Wednesday night speaking to you guys? I love getting into Alcoholics Anonymous all over the place. You know, I've had the privilege to speak all over the place recently, and it's a blessing. Of course, I never loved doing it. I don't like doing it. I don't want to do it. But when I do it, I feel so great afterwards. You know, and that's part of that giving back. And I know some people have struggled with the Zoom thing because I've had some guys that, you know, just don't want to do it. You know, it's not the same. It doesn't feel the same. I can't see the people. You know, and I just want to point it out that in the last paragraph in the foreword of the fourth edition, it talks about, it says, while our literature has preserved the integrity of the AA message, sweeping changes in society as a whole are reflected in new customs and practices within our fellowship. Taking advantage of technological advances, for example, AA members with computers can participate in meetings online, sharing with fellow alcoholics across the country and around the world. In any meeting, anywhere, AA share experience, strength, and hope with each other in order to stay sober and help other alcoholics. Modem to modem, face to face. You know, AA speak the language of the heart. And when I heard that, it was like, wow. You know, did they know? Like, how did they know this already? Like, they knew that this was going to happen, you know, of March of 2020, that we were all of a sudden have to jump into computers. You know, it just blows my mind that they had thought about everything. You know, that's the book that I try to run my life by. And some days I do good at it, and some days I don't. You know, I'm still a self and self-centered human being. And, you know, so I just love reading that because it just shows you, like, you can't debate it. Talks about it in the book. It's what we do. And, you know, so I was told what it's like, what happened, and what it's like now. You know, I grew up in an alcoholic drug addict family. I grew up seeing my father abuse my mother on a daily basis. Whether it was verbally, physically, emotionally, or all at the same time. You know, and it was a normal day in my childhood to sit there and see that ever-revolving door swinging all hours of the night. Of the people coming in and out of the houses, why we're out there doing the things that we do. You know, that's what I grew up seeing, the things that I ended up doing later in life that I told myself that I wasn't going to do. You know, the dealers, the loud parties, the drunken brawls, you know, the sketchy people, you know, and thinking that it's normal. I have an older sister, and there's four of us with my mom and my dad, you know, and we're a very tight family. And you know, and I can remember days of not knowing what we're going to do, how are we going to eat, how are we going to do this stuff. You know, how come we don't get to go anywhere? How come we don't have anything? You know, why are there always strange people in my house? You know, what is that my dad's doing? What is that my mom's doing? You know, it was a normal day to see my mom hitting the pipe or drinking, and same thing with my dad. And, you know, and I remember one night we were huddled up together in on a blown up air mattress in the bedroom at a condo when we lived in Oceanside. And, you know, we're all sitting there crying, not knowing why we're here. How come we're here? You know, we've seen other kids that had the good life. And here we are, you know, struggling to do any of these things that we really wanted as kids. You know, but we didn't know any other way, you know, and you know, so we bounced around a lot, Oceanside, and Ontario, this little town called Eagle Rock right here next to Glendale. And, you know, it was constantly bouncing around. Just that geographics, you know, that I eventually did later in my life. My parents were doing it. They were full-blown alcoholic drug addicts, you know, and they were dragging kids with us, you know, and they dragged us around, and they dragged us through all of that, and we seen it. You know, the knockout fights in the gas station, you know, my mom dragging us, taking us away, you know, we got to get away from him, you know, and that was what it was like, you know. And then, you know, for, of course, you know, like a good alcoholic addict, you know, couple, they would, you know, reconcile the next morning. Oh, you know, it wasn't that bad, you know, and come together for us kids. And, you know, we ended up back in Eagle Rock, and everything seemed to be going fine for a while. I had finally started school, you know, but I remember I was always that kid that was defiant. Like if I didn't get my way, then I was running away. If you didn't give me attention, I was running away. If you told me something that I didn't like, I was talking back. You know, I was definitely defiant by nature from the earliest age that I could remember. You know, I remember this one time I told my mom I'm running away, and, you know, I packed that bag and I ran out that door, and I just kind of went on right next to the door. No one came after me, you know, and I remember sitting there saying, no one loves me, no one cares about me, you know, and that was my childhood. And, you know, it was shortly thereafter that there was a knock on the door, and it was the DCFS and the police, and, you know, the neighbors didn't think my parents were fit neighbors, you know, and they walked in, they asked where my mother was. My mom was passed out in the bedroom. I was the one that was told to go get her. So I had to get in there and I had to wake her up. But I remember, you know, this is a day, I don't remember a lot of my childhood, but I remember this day like it was yesterday. You know, and she woke up, and before she walked out that bedroom door, she cleared off all that paraphernalia off the top of the dresser. She walked out into the living room, and they placed her in handcuffs and they took us away. That was the first day that my mom and my dad had some sort of, you know, consequences of their drinking and using, and they lost their kids. You know, you would think that they would do something to kind of get their kids back, but no, they didn't. You know, luckily we were able to go with my grandparents, and that's when I moved to West Covina, and I started living with my grandparents, you know, and these are, they're elderly, and they were doing the best they can, but I'm that defiant kid. I hated being in the life, I hated being in the family that I had, bottom line. I didn't think that I deserved it. I didn't think that I got enough attention. I didn't think that I was loved. You know, but mind you, like, my grandparents showed me so much love, it's unbelievable. And, you know, my mom came shortly thereafter, you know, and kind of put the pieces back together. And my dad was, I called him the holiday father. You know, I'd hear from him on my birthday, and I would see him on Christmas Eve, you know, and that was it. You know, and I grew up listening to my mother badmouth my father. He doesn't want anything to do with you. He doesn't want any of that. So these are the things that I'm taught, and I'm listening to my mom telling me these things. So I just get this anger and this rage inside of me, and it makes me want to defy against anybody. You know, and the only people that I could do was in school. You know, so from an early age, I'm getting kicked out of school in first grade, second grade, third grade. You know, constantly sent to the principal's office, talking to the school counselor, doing all those things, you know. Hanging out with the older guys in the neighborhood, man. The older guys in the neighborhood, what were they doing? They were drinking and using. You know, and that stuff looked great to me. You know, working on dirt bikes, hanging out all hours of the night. You know, and it led me to getting drunk when I was 13 years old. You know, I was 13. It was my 13th birthday. My uncle was kind of this father figure in my life. You know, my uncle is 55 years old now. He's still a tweaker to this day. I don't know how he gets away with it. I don't get into it. Because then it makes me resentful at him. Like, how can he do it for 40-something years have a career, big truck, house, and I'm like, I don't want to, it's not a good place for me. I get envious of people, you know, and that's a dangerous spot for me to be in. I just got to pray for him. You know, but so that's the guy that I had in my life, and he got me drunk off some Miller Red Dog when I was 13 years old, and I remember climbing the hills in the neighborhood, hanging out with his buddy, and you know, it was a blast. You know, and I remember passed out on the bed just spinning there thinking like, man, I can't wait to do this again. Like, this is it. You know, I had finally felt that. You know, meanwhile, I'm 13 years old, I'm in sixth grade, I'm 6 foot, I'm a big kid, I'm constantly fighting. You know, and I grew up, you know, the school that I went to, they were just done with me. They were tired of me being the person that I was. And so I'm in sixth grade, and basically they told me that they didn't want me at that school anymore. And I only had to go to school for 3 periods, my sixth, seventh, and eighth grade year. Basically, I had to go to PE, drama, and then math class. And then they had a special bus come pick me up, and I was supposed to go volunteer at an elementary school. But I was able to manipulate that bus driver to getting me to letting me out down the street. And now I'm 13, 14 years old, and I'm done with school at 10:30 in the morning. And that just left all kinds of time. You know, next thing you know, I'm smoking weed out of a homemade Suave. It was a homemade bong out of a Suave shampoo bottle. It still tastes bubbly and soapy when I hit it for the first time, but I didn't care because it made me feel different. You know, and I loved that effect, and, you know, we ended up moving out, and I started drinking on my daily basis when I was 15. There were some guys that lived next to us when we moved there, and, you know, it was never one, it was never two, it was the bottle, it was 240s, it was 340s, let's go buy a case of 32-ounce Miller High Life, you know, and let's do this, let's get, you know, a bottle of Jack Daniels, you know, and I want my own bottle of Jack Daniels. You know, and that's how I drank from the very beginning. You know, because when I was 15 and we moved out, my mom's an enabling mother. She didn't care. She let me do what I want. I'm the man of the house. You know, she told me, I know you're going to drink. I'd rather have you drink at my house than out there in the streets getting into trouble. So I rode that, you know. Her one rule was don't drink my beer. You know, don't drink my alcohol. You know, and it was easy at the time because that was when she was drinking like Michelob and Zima. And then she liked to drink this gin. I hated gin, and that was her drink. So it was easy for me to stay away. But I'll tell you what, when I didn't have anything, I was in her cupboard. You know, because it didn't matter. Once I started drinking, I couldn't stop. You know, and I tried to stay away from those substances that allowed me to stay up longer and drink more. And I was able to stay strong for a while, but I eventually found that because I realized that I was able to drink substantially more, you know, and be up all hours of the night. I love being out there at night partying. And, you know, during all of this, you know, I'm in school, I'm not in school, I'm ditching school. School was just more of an inconvenience. It was getting in the way of me drinking and using, you know, and I didn't like it. You know, and I'd periodically see my grandparents that raised us. We'd go to their house, you know, and my grandfather is an alcoholic, and you know, my grandmother would always tell me, you know, you're going to be just like your grandfather. You're going to be just like your grandfather. No, I'm not going to be like you. You're going to be just like your uncle. No, I'm not going to be like that. You know, and it got to the point where she used to have to hide her alcohol in the vegetable crisper because she knew I wasn't going in there, you know, so she could come home and have a cold beer at night. You know, it got to the point where people were hiding alcohol from me because they knew how I drank. You know, and I did that for a few years, you know, and then my mom thought it was a good idea to move to Fontana, and I thought it was going to be a new start, and I found my people out there, and mind you, like, this time I have a career now. I'm working for the L.A. County Sanitation District. I'm doing big things. I'm making good money, but I have this heavy, heavy drinking problem. You know, the relationship went south, and I went to the bottle, and, you know, and that's where I found my joy, you know, and next thing I know, I found myself alone in that garage in Fontana, drinking alcohol all hours of the night by myself. It went from socializing, you know, social drinking with people, and then none of them drank like me. And then next thing you know, I'm by myself in the garage with a bottle, you know, and finally it was enough. I wanted to go to the river, and that job wouldn't let me, so I I quit it. I went to the river. I partied. I came home. I had no job. And my younger sister lived in San Diego at the time. And, you know, so I went down to San Diego for the weekend. It was it was July of 2003. And I went down there for my birthday, and I basically told her that I'm moving in, and I never left. You know, because when I got down there, man, I felt like I had arrived. You know, she lived right on the bay. The bay was here. The beach was here. You could drink legally on the beach down there. So we're having cake parties. Like, it was the Mecca, man. It was amazing. You know, but I was introduced to Jägermeister down there, and Jägermeister was the death of me. It really was. You know, Jägermeister and Double Jack and Cokes caused a world of pain for me down there. You know, mind you know, the book talks about like a tornado ripping through people's lives. You know, like I ripped through my poor sister's life. Like she had no idea who she had let move in with her. And I turned 21 down there. So the first time I went to a bar when I was 21, I've only drank at two bars when I was 21. First time, Double Jack and Coke and Jägermeister. I picked a fight with five or six guys. I used some girl I was with as a shield. And, you know, and they didn't want to fight me one-on-one. She didn't get hurt. They socked me. Then I kicked a newspaper stand, socked the mailbox. My sister's bawling, crying. I'm limping. I'm bloody. And next thing you know, I ended up in the emergency room. You know, and for the first time in my life, I remember laying on that gurney getting a CAT scan, crying, not knowing how I got here. How did I get here? All I remember is going to the bar, and here I am one more time. You know, those fleeting thoughts come through my head. Those, you know, kind of those spiritual awakenings, you know, but then they're fleeting. They're gone. You know, and justify it. If I just won't do the Jägermeister anymore, patched me up, sent me on my way. I'm on crutches from that incident at a bar a week later, still milking that 21st birthday, Double Jack and Cokes, come out of a blackout, fought another guy. And I'm laying in my sister's bathtub crying, and she's crying, and she's telling me I can't do this anymore. That wasn't my intention. My intention was not to go down there and tear apart her life. My intention was to go down there and try to start a new life. I was constantly creating wreckage in anybody's life, blowing bridges up. I didn't know. I didn't know that I was doing those things until I walked into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous and did some work on myself that I was hurting people. I didn't even think I was hurting myself. How am I going to think that I'm hurting other people if I don't think I'm hurting myself? And I had some people point out to me that I'm a selfish, selfish human being. You know, they didn't use those kind words. They told it some pretty bluntly, and I had to wake up. You know, so finally, I'm 21 years old. I had to call my mom, come pick me up. I got nowhere to go. She came down, she picked me up, and I went back to Fontana. So the father that I didn't have in my life, that was the holiday father, I started drinking on a daily basis when I was 15. He got sober when I was 15. I have no recollection of it. I don't remember, you know, but it's not surprising. I was in my disease, full flight from reality. You know, I didn't know what was going on around me. My siblings were there. They were part of his life. They were, you know, celebrating with him, celebrating his milestones, his 1, 2, 3, 4 years. I have no clue. You know, but I knew that he would always put me to work when I needed some money. He would never give me money, but he would put me to work. So I got back to Fontana and I called him up, said, hey, I need to make some money. He said, all right, man, come on out to Glendale. I'll put you to work. Came out to Glendale. I totally thought that I was going to come out here and drink some, you know, smoke some weed, drink some beer with him, you know, and do all that stuff. But I'd be out here with him during the week, and he'd take off 1, 2, 3 nights a week, you know, and he's going to meetings. I had no idea where he was going. Of course, I'm not going to ask. I don't really care. You know, that was my attitude. I was only there to make money. I didn't really want this guy to be part of my life. He wasn't part of my life. He didn't want to be part of my life. You know, he was just a means for me to get some money. That's how I looked at him. You know, what can I get? It's all about me. And that's what I did. You know, but then I would go out, I would work in Glendale, I'd go home on the weekends, and I'd party it up. I'd come back out there, he's like, how's your weekend? Go, oh man, I drank a couple beers, yeah, I had a good time, hung out with some friends. Meanwhile, I'm bottles deep in some, at this point in time, I'm drinking $1.99 charcoal filtered Barton vodka. The bottom of the barrel stuff. And gallons of Carlos Arasi Sangria, because I felt I felt good when I was drinking that Carlo Rossi. You know, put a couple little, you know, chunks of apples and some strawberries in it, you know, and a big old 32-ounce cup. Who drinks that stuff like that? Like, not normal people. Like, mind you, when I was in San Diego, I was drinking mimosas out of the 64-ounce 7-Eleven big gold cup. Like, that's how I drank it. A bottle of champagne and a splash of orange juice. And let's go smashing down the boardwalk. I'm ready to go. Like, that's how I drank. Like, you know, and people would look at you like, I'm whatever. You know, walking down the boardwalk with literally a gallon of Jack Daniels, just chugging it. You know, wearing it like a badge of honor. You know, and that's how I drank. And you know, so that went on for a few weeks. That was in October, November. I hadn't went home for a few weeks. So I had about a little over $2,000. Thanksgiving weekend came up. And basically, I went home on that Tuesday before Thanksgiving. And that money was gone by Thursday. And I didn't know why. I mean, I knew why, but I didn't know how it was gone so quickly. Because at that point in time, I was buying stuff to keep people around me. You know, and I remember that Thanksgiving. You know, I'm walking around with a 40 in my hand at Thanksgiving dinner. You know, blasting Pink Floyd. My grandfather's yelling at me. You know, my mom's yelling at me. I didn't care. You know, this is what I wanted to do. You know, and it was that Sunday after Thanksgiving, after being up all night in the back of the closet, smoking some rocked up alcohol. And drinking that Jack Daniels. My dad called me and asked me if I was going to come to work on that Sunday after Thanksgiving. You know, what came out of my mouth was, I did it one more time and I needed help. I had no idea that that's what was going to come out of my mouth. You know, the book talks about deep down every man, woman, and child, there's that fundamental idea of God, and I truly, truly believe that God was working in my life that day. You know, because my intention was to tell him, yeah, I'm ready to go back to work. But somehow, deep down inside of my body, that I knew he was the man that I needed to ask for help. You know, and I know today that he was praying for me to walk into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous at the end of every meeting that he was attending to. You know, and he told me to pack a bag, like he had been waiting. You know, all right, man, I'll see you in the morning. Pack a bag. I left Fontana that day, and I didn't return. You know, he came and picked me up. Didn't talk about it the whole day. Because I tell you what, my attitude had changed that next day. No, it wasn't that bad. You know, if I only stay away from this, then I won't get to that point. You know? We didn't talk about it until the ride home. We were working in Costa Mesa all the way back to Glendale. And he asked me, how'd it go? I said, dude, I bought a 30-pack to last me, you know, all weekend, and it was gone that night. And he's identifying. I bought a big bottle of Jack Daniels to last me all weekend. It was gone that night. And he's identifying. For the first time in my life, someone was identifying with the way I drank, and it was my father. The man that I hated, that I despised, that I didn't want to have anything to do with. And I think that's Alcoholics Anonymous, because if Alcoholics Anonymous wasn't there for him, he wouldn't have been there for me. You know, that's how this thing works. One alcoholic helping another. Doesn't matter if it's friends, not friends, father, son. In my case, it was my father carrying that message to me. You know, and he walked me into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous on December 1st of 2003, and I haven't found it necessary to take a drink of use since then. There's been a lot of no matter what. I would love to tell you that I walked into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous that day, and I jumped into the big book, and I got a God, and I got a sponsor, and I started trying to pack these fences with my life. Absolutely not. I didn't think I was an alcoholic at that point. I'm 21 years old. I couldn't relate to anybody in that meeting. It was all older gentlemen. You know, they had been drinking for 20, 30 years. I'd only drank from that time. I'd only been drinking consistent every day for 6 years. You know, and I couldn't relate. But the problem was, is because I wasn't listening to the similarities. You know, but they didn't send me away. They let me sit there in that meeting and figure it out in my head. And I sat there, you know, week after week. And finally, it was 2.5 weeks in there. Of all people, this 5-foot Armenian guy named Varush told my story. And from that moment on, I raised my hand as an alcoholic, you know, and I knew that I was where I was supposed to be. You know, but I still didn't get into the work because I still thought I was different. I thought if I just take away the, if I just took away the drugs and the alcohol, that my life would get better. My life did get better. It totally did. I was fortunate. I had a job. I had things. I wasn't buying stuff, so I had money in my pocket. I was going to meetings. But like I told you, one of my first addiction was women back in the day, early age, girls, then women. You know, so I ran to the women in AA, you know, and I fixed on them, and I got with them, and I used them, and I created a whole hell of a lot of wreckage, more than I needed to, stone cold sober. And I got into a relationship, and that relationship went south. You know, and I came to that fork in the road. What am I going to do? Am I going to drink, or am I going to get into action? You know, and I switched sponsors, and I got into the work. You know, it was one of those things that I never really wanted to do. I didn't want to find out those hard facts about myself. I didn't want to find out that I'm a selfish, self-centered, egotistical man. Like, that's not stuff that I want to hear. You know, and that I'm sensitive. Oh, and super needy. You know, I'm the guy that walks around the house here right now, 17 years sober, and asking my wife, do you love me? Do you love me? Like, tell me you love me. Like, dude, she's with me. She puts up with me. She definitely loves me. But that's me. You know, and those are the things that I have to work on a daily basis, you know? So I got into that work, and I got into those steps, and I got into service, you know? And I shared that fifth step with that man, and I let those things go, those things that were keeping me from the sunlight of the Spirit, you know, for all those years. And after that, you know, my life and my sobriety changed, you know? And I told myself that I needed to do some work on myself. I needed to figure out who I was. I'm not getting in a relationship. My sponsor's like, that's a good idea. You know, and he was always big on, like, you know, Jeremy, how free do you want to be? Like, man, I want to be free. Well, then you got to do what we do. We go to meetings every day. The meeting starts 30 minutes before the actual meeting starts. If you're not there 30 minutes before the meeting, then you're late to the meeting. You know, that's how I was brought up. You know, you be of service. You say yes. You never say no. No matter how big an inconvenience it is. You know, and that's what I did. You know, so I'm trying to stay out of this relationship, and I'm a GSR, and I met my wife, you know, when I was in that bad relationship. She was in a bad relationship. We would periodically run into each other. I knew I wanted to date her, but I was in a relationship. And then both our relationships, like, blew up at the same time, and we ran into each other, and I asked her if she would come lead a young people's meeting. You know, and she told me, well, I'm not a young person. I'm like, just give me your number, man. Let me just call you. And that was it. You know, but I was scared because I wasn't supposed to be dating anybody. And my sponsor told me these simple rules. Look, Jeremy, you don't got to run from a relationship, but you also don't, or you don't have to run into a relationship, but you don't have to run from one either. And I did things differently. You know, because finally, at this point in time, I knew those facts for myself. I knew those things that, why I did those things, you know, in my previous, I don't know, lifetime, in my previous relationship. You know, that I need to not make it about me always, you know, and continue to rebuild these relationships that I have in my life. You know, and when I was 2.5 years sober, my grandmother, my Nana, that's the one that took us, raised us, she was my everything, man. She was my life. She was diagnosed with ALS. And I told myself that I was just going to drink. When she goes, it's going to be the easier, softer way. That's it. I don't want to deal with it. You know, and I didn't. You know, because by that time I knew what I needed to do, and I put my hands out to Alcoholics Anonymous, and they carried me through that. You know, but from her death is when I became that, I've gotten that conscious contact with this God that I have in my life. My God is, I don't know what my God is. I don't want to know. I keep it real simple. It ain't me. You know, and I pray to it, and I turn it over on a daily basis. You know, sometimes more. It was amazing to me when I realized that, you know, oh, you know, you get up, wake up, you turn your will and your life over to God, cool, you carry on through the day, oh, that's it. You took your will back, you got to start over the next day. Like, nah, man, I learned that I could turn my will and my life over to God as many times as I need to in a day. You know, and sometimes it's more, sometimes it's not. You know, but with each death that I've walked through with family members, AA members, sober, them dying sober, not sober, that conscious contact with a God in my life has gotten deeper and bigger and stronger. You know, I don't know what's the connection. I try not to think about it, but I just know that feeling's there. And, you know, so that's going on. And, me and Amy are starting the date. You know, and she started going to Pacoima. Meanwhile, the meetings that I used to go to before me and her started dating, it was the meetings where I would be hanging out at the half measure stand after the first half of the meeting. You know, or I'm in the first half of the meeting and I'm talking to the meetings and I had no structure in my life. I was just kind of running on self-will, still sober, doing things how I wanted. 5 years of sobriety. If you weren't doing it my way, you weren't doing it the right way. You know, when I walked into Pacoima, you know, when I saw what it's truly about. You know, and they showed me unconditional love. And they showed me the true connection with God. And they showed me that I can't stay sober if I don't have a mighty God in my life. You know, and that was one of the best things. And, you know, so we're dating and we're going through those things. And Alcoholics Anonymous has always been first and foremost in my relationship. It doesn't matter, what we have going on. She knows that AA is before her. And I know that AA is before me, you know, and we got married. I remember when I knew that I was proposed to her. I don't know if she told you, so she was going through a master's program. I proposed to her in Santa Cruz, and, you know, these are the beautiful gifts that I've had that I didn't know that I wanted. I didn't know when I walked in there at 21 years old that I wanted to have this beautiful sunset beach wedding on the island of Kauai. Like, who knew? I didn't know that I wanted butterflies released after I say I do to the woman I love. I did. She wouldn't let me have it, but I did want that, you know, and we had the picture perfect wedding, you know, and I didn't know. I could have missed it all. If I wouldn't have chose to stick around here and be willing and find out these hard facts about myself, I would have missed it all, you know, and we had that wedding and we had a meeting after. Alcoholics Anonymous is built around my life. He said, I do at 4 o'clock, at 8 o'clock the next morning. There was, I think, 8 or 9 Alcoholics Anonymous members sitting around the pool having a meeting before we went off to our honeymoon. You know, that's just the way we live. You know, that's not a normal, that wasn't a normal thing in my life. You know, all I ever wanted in life was to be part of. Little did I know, once I walked into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, that I was finally going to get that feeling. You know, and I get to share it with someone that I love. You know, and we came back and, you know, we decided that we wanted to have kids, which stirred up a whole nother series of issues in my life. You know, I talk about, like, my life, my sobriety has been like a series of surrenders. One more time, here we are, God, what are we going to do? Am I going to get into work or am I not? You know, and it brought up these emotions of, I don't want to be the father that I didn't have or the father that I did have. I don't want to be that father. You know, and it made me want to go do stupid things. You know, and I remember the day that we found out that we were pregnant with my oldest daughter, Zoe. She's 9 years old now. Oof, 9 years old. I've been married 12 years. I have a 9-year-old daughter. It's crazy. When I hear it, it's like wild. You know, and I do everything for her. You know, and you know, so we have my little girl, we have her, and it's great, everything's great. You know, we decided to have another one, and we have Sadie. Sadie's 7 now. You know, and she's like the happy-spirited kid. She's the one that, you know, I have to go to meetings, I gotta talk to a sponsor, I gotta practice these principles, I gotta pray to God to try to live in the moment. That little kid's like in the moment. Like, no matter what time, what a day, what's going on in her life, she's just there. You know, and I strive to be like that, and it's the most beautiful thing to watch. And they have a sober father today. You know, they have that life that I didn't have. You know, I always told myself that I'm going to give these kids everything that I didn't have. And, you know, and I've done my damnedest to give that to them. You know, they've never seen me drink. They've definitely seen me under the influence of alcoholism. You know, because I'm not a perfect human being. You know, but I've been at every school function, no matter how big, small, or whatever it is, I've been there. Because I know how important it was for me that I didn't have that. You know, and one of the best things that I get to do today as a father, as a sober father, is I get to drop him off at school. You know, and I'm not that father that gets to just kick him out the car at the gate. Not that that's a bad thing, but that's just not, these are things that I found out about myself that these are what I wish I had. You know, when I park that car and I get out of that car and I hold their hand and I walk them across the street and I watch them walk to the gate and then I watch them walk across the blacktop to go with their friends. Like, those were the things that I wanted. I didn't know that I wanted that until I had kids. I didn't know how important that was to me until I had kids. Constantly peeling back the layers of the onion, showing me what I want in my life, or what I didn't have, and how much it actually truly affected me. You know, and that's, I went a little too far though. I got involved, and I'm actually a board member of the PTA now. You know, like, it's crazy. This guy, a sober dad today, a member of the PTA. If they only knew. Hope to die drunk. Hope to die alcoholic addict. If they only knew who has keys to the school. You know? But they know me around there. They know me as Zoe and Sadie's dad. You know? Not as, there's that guy, there's that tweaker, there's that drunk. They know that they could count on me, that I'll be there. That the principal could call me and say they need something done at the school, and I'm there. They found out that, you know, I'm a contractor, and next thing you know, the teacher's lounge needed to be remodeled. And here we are. It was a 4-day process. But I'll tell you what, that experience taught me what true gratitude is. You know, to give completely freely, not expecting anything, and to see the tears and the smiles of the joy of the teachers on their faces, that's what it was about. That's Alcoholics Anonymous. I wouldn't do that today if it wasn't for you guys. I don't know how to be that person. I don't know how to be a sober person. I'm selfish and self-centered to the core. You know, I was 10 years sober, and I was acting out on some selfish thoughts and some selfish needs. Texting with some random person, and my wife saw it, almost cost me this marriage. I talk about it because those are the things that I need to get out there so I can hear the insanity and the sickness that still goes on in my head at 10 years of sobriety, stone cold sober. Almost cost me everything that I love so dearly. But I'll tell you what, she knows we've worked through it, and this marriage is far deeper and more connected than it ever has been from that. Only because I was willing to do some work on myself one more time. You know, and that father that I have in that's in my life now, he's my business partner. You know, we got a company together. I'm with him every single day. I love it. A man that I didn't have part of my life for 21 years. I've been with him every day for the last 17 years. And it's all, the relationship we had has been grown in Alcoholics Anonymous. What better place? You know, and I truly, truly love it. You know, and I have my brothers, my sisters, my siblings, you know, you know, they're all grateful to be part of, or I'm grateful to be part of their life, but they're so grateful that I'm part of Alcoholics Anonymous. I remember when I walked into the rooms, I was scared to let them all know that I was basically, I felt like I was giving up. Like, I can't drink, so I'm just giving up now. And every single one of them told me that it was probably the best thing I could do for my life. You know? I didn't laugh. Jeremy's always the last to know that I had a problem. You know? They all seen it. I was 3 years sober when my mom would tell me that she would sit there and drive from San Clemente to Fontana every night. Stupid train. You know, crying. And funny joke about the train. So this train goes by every night. Constantly. Me and Amy are watching a movie, and we're like, goddamn train. My brother's a conductor for Union Pacific. So now it is, every time that train goes by, we're like, goddamn Budsy, you know, like blowing his horn. It's just funny, because now it's just kind of the rolling joke, because he just gets blamed for everything because he's driving the damn train. You know, but anyways, it's... My siblings, you know, and so my oldest one, I think I'm getting close to, yeah. I'll say this and shut up. My older sister, she was the one that would have knockout, drag out fights, bloody noses, everything. She was the one that I banged heads with so much. When we had our first daughter, Zoe, she was at my house every weekend on Sundays. So me and Amy could go to meetings. She would drive from Riverside to Glendale. It's like 85 miles. You know, and I'll never forget that. And that's only because I was a sober man today and a sober father. You know, and I want to remember to stay grateful for the things that I have and I don't have in my life. Because if I ain't grateful, I ain't sane. That's as simple as that. You know, and I got to remember that. You know, I'll end with this. The seeds of discouragement cannot take root in a grateful heart. Thank you for letting me share.
Thank you so much, Jeremy. Can we have a round of applause?